This is part three of a three-part interview with Lieutenant Commander John C. Ench, United States Navy. This interview is being conducted at the Naval Air Station Miramar, San Diego, California, on 26 March 1974. The interviewer is Captain R.A. Bowling, United States Navy retired, graduate student at San Diego State University.
Okay,
Commander, if you continue, please.
All right. So I was saying I got in with the other prisoners, and from then on it was kind of smooth sailing for me in the fact that the other prisoners were able to kind of take care of me and nurse me along and help me with my wound and everything, although the medical attention that I received from the North Vietnamese was almost nothing. I ended up having a wound in my hand, an open wound, seeping wound, for 5.5 months. But thanks to the other prisoners, they helped me through, and I have use of my hand today. As I said, it was pretty smooth sailing in. Things started improving in October of 72, or 70. Yeah, excuse me, 72. Vietnamese started giving us a lot more privileges. They started letting us mix the newest POWs, mixing with the older shoot downs, and food improved a little bit, and much more outside time, and ping pong and volleyball were allowed and established in the camp. And this, of course, was when the first peace negotiations were being conducted, and then they fell through, and the Vietnamese immediately withdrew these added privileges, and we got all kinds of propaganda over the radio that the squawk boxes, as we called loudspeakers in each cell, of how the United States and South Vietnam had undermined the North Vietnamese efforts for peace. And this is always the slant of the broadcast of how the North Vietnamese had tried to make peace, and that the Americans and the South Vietnamese lackey government, as they called it, had undermined these efforts. And the North Vietnamese had been in good faith, and we were in bad faith in these negotiations. And then the B-52s started hitting December 18th, 1972, and all hell broke loose.
You seem to remember that date real, right off the top.
Yeah, I do, because it was one of the guys I was in with, a Air Force captain, Ken Wells. It was his birthday, and we were giving him a birthday party that day. We saved a little bit of goodies aside and kind of had a little party for him after they locked us up for the final time that day. And I remembered it because we kidded him about, we didn't realize that we were going to have fireworks for his birthday. And B-52's raids were that night and continued in through the end of December. And the Vietnamese were very, very uptight about these things. They were scared to death. And having gone through all these raids, I can imagine, or I can understand their being scared of these things. It's a frightening experience to go through one of these things. And we knew that they weren't trying to hit us, and we were, you know, our prison was pinpointed, and we knew that they were staying well clear of us. But to go through one of those raids knowing that they're trying to kill you, I think would be enough to unnerve anybody.
What was the impact of these raids on POW morale?
Oh, well, the morale, it was great for the morale. The privileges and the outside time and the food and everything, it took a hit. Went down a little bit, but as far as the morale, 99% of the POWs, I think, was great, because we could see the Vietnamese were were losing their, I don't know how to put it.
Say it.
Their cool. They were really uptight and nervous about these things, short-tempered, and the guards, everybody was, they started fortifying the little foxholes they had dug in the concrete, and they were really, really worried. After the raids then, raids stopped, and they moved my group, the new POWs, out of this compound we called Camp Unity into another section of the Hanoi Hilton, which we called New Guy Village, and we were kept over there for 10 days. And it was when I first realized that we were probably going home, was I had been refused to, or I had not been allowed, they had refused to allow, I should say, me to write a letter because I was classified as a, they called it, their expression was, you have a bad attitude. You're a non-cooperator. And as most of the, as everybody, I guess, in the Hanoi Hilton was. And while we were in New Guy Village, they called me out in the end of December, or in end of January, and they said, okay, you and you and you and you, and they pointed out all of us that had never been allowed to write a letter, took us over and said, you write a letter home. So immediately after that, I had just finished writing my letter, I remember, and the camp commander came in, assembled us all, and through an interpreter started reading the protocol and reading the announcement that the peace agreement had been signed in Paris. As per the agreement, they had to notify us within 5 days. And this was about the third day after the signing. And a little humorous part of this, I think, was that he read this and he says, now, according to the agreement, we didn't have to tell you for 5 days, but in our goodness and benevolence, you notice we're telling you within 3 days. We're beating the agreement. So after he was gone, we all got a laugh about that, to think that the wonderful DRVN had beat the deadline by 2 days. And then we were given copies of the protocol as it called for, and the agreements and everything for us, ourselves, you know, in English, for us to read and see if they were following them. And the 1st of February, we were moved out of that area, put into trucks, and taken over to the camp that we called the Zoo. It was also in the Hanoi area. And that's where I stayed for the next 2 months until I was released with the last group on the 29th of March 1973, which I might add was a day late in releasing to the DRVN. That's one deadline they didn't make.
Yeah, before we leave Vietnam, I know you want to get away from there, but two questions that came up and I didn't want to interrupt. Did the North Vietnamese, refer to what was going on out there as a war? Is that the term they would use?
No, I don't think I ever heard them use the word war. It was always a imperialistic United States. They didn't really call it a war. It was.
They ever called you like a war criminal?
Oh, yeah, we were referred to as war criminals. But I'm trying to think of the term that they. I can't think of what. But not really war. That doesn't. It wasn't really a war. It was the. Let me think of that. They referred to aggression was a big word with them, like we were the imperialistic United States aggressors. War of aggression was, I guess, was anytime you heard war, it was always in that terms. Never.
One other question, Commander. Have you heard about the one Navy squadron commander who willingly cooperated with the North Vietnamese?
Yes.
And he has since admitted it. Was he in the Hilton with you all?
No. I was in camp with him only briefly when I went to the zoo for about a period of 5 or 6 days, and then he was moved out of, he and his Marine friend were moved out of that camp over into a camp we called a plantation, and with other people shot down in his same time frame to be released. They put us all according to time frames and released us from camps. So I was never in with him, never met him personally. I saw him, saw them a couple of times through a crack in the wall where we were, in our courtyard wall. All I know is what I was told by other prisoners, older prisoners.
Do you know if they, okay, it's hearsay, but was the word around out that they were receiving better treatment?
Yes.
Much better, or just a little bit better?
Well, I don't know. During the period of time that I was there, they had kind of an open-door policy, I guess, as far as their cell was concerned. It opened in the morning and closed at night. And they were free to wander in and out as they pleased. And the rest of us were locked up, except for a couple hours a day, outside to wash, and eat, and then back in. I had heard that they received much better treatment than the other prisoners during their time frame.
Was it a pretty well-known fact in the camp that these people had cooperated willingly?
Yes, I think so.
What was the impact of that fact on the prisoners as a whole?
Well, it was disappointing to think that a fellow American fighting man had done this, I think, but and anger in some cases, pity in others, and just frustration in others, I guess, to think that they would do this. We had instructions that we were not to take any orders from them if we were ever in with them.
Those instructions came from where?
Came from the senior officers in POW.
And who were those senior officers?
Well, there was General Flynn, and who was the senior officer. All these policies from the more senior officers in the camps,
in the
wherever you were.
The Geneva Conference, military discipline did hold, except for some of these, and then orders were out not to obey any orders passed by.
They had been relieved of any command. So, like I say, that's all I know about the case. And
can you remember the commander's name? He's now a captain, retired.
I think it was the names were Wilbur and Miller, of the two that I recall. And like I said, I don't want to judge them, because I guess nobody knows what you're going to do in a given situation. But
did you hear
from the stories
that tortured or anything like that?
No, I heard that there, some of the other prisoners had suffered because of them, had been, they had informed on other prisoners and caused other prisoners hardships, and that's the thing that I can't forgive. If I would think that if a man wanted to cooperate, or whatever term you want to use it, that you ought at least limit it to yourself and not cause others who wanted to try to stick by the code of the conduct and the rules that we as American fighting men have. I think that you should at least let those people resist to the fullest extent that they want to without going to the enemy and telling them, squealing on them, if you will. And so, like I say, that's the thing that I would object to in this particular instance. charges were brought against them when they came back by Admiral Stockdale as the senior naval officer in Vietnam and or North Vietnam, and the charges were dropped by the Secretary of the Navy, and so I guess that justice has been served in the fact that charges were brought formally, as I think they should have been. From what I know of the case, the Secretary of the Navy saw fit to discharge or dismiss the charges because of, he said, the suffering has already been caused both to them and to their families, and he sees no reason to further it now, and I just go along with that because that's, you know, Secretary of the Navy is, he's my boss, so my estimation is that I guess justice has been served. I think that everybody knows or realizes that they did not, what I would say, serve honorably during that period of time. The case is closed, I guess, as far as I'm concerned. I don't wish anything on them. I hope that in the future we never have this to contend with again.
Commander, back to this code of conduct, fighting man's code. It has been said that it's impractical, it really can't work, and so forth and so on. Do you have any comments or ideas on that subject?
Well, I think it's it was a good point to start from. It was a good guideline to give you something to go by. The fact that they can probably, depending upon the individual, and everybody has their breaking point, as they say, some can outlast others, I guess, but I think that the enemy could probably, if they want to break you, if you want to use that word, so I think that the code of conduct, it's undergoing right now a study and seeing where it can be revised or changed or whatever, and I think that this is wise to try to learn from what we've brought back as to what is really practical and what you should be expected, how far you should be expected to resist. I think that we will see a change in it, but it was the only guidelines I had, and it served me, I think.
Now, as a POW commander, do you feel, have different ideas? One is that there should be no restraints whatsoever. Once you're captured, well, then no holds barred. The other one, of course, is the Holy Four, as you said, name, rank, serial number, date of birth. As a previous POW, where do you think the answer might lie?
I think it lies somewhere between the two. I disagree completely with the idea that once you're captured, that's it, because even though you're captured, it doesn't mean, you're not discharged from the service. You're still a fighting man, and you still have to work at it. But on the other hand, I say, just because you're captured doesn't mean you stop serving, you stop resisting. And on the other hand, if you try to stick with the name, rank, service number, and date of birth, it's pretty hard, especially depending upon the condition that you're in when you're captured, and how much pressure the enemy applies to you. And I think the most important time is immediately after you're captured, is that, because that's when you would have some tactical information that might be of use to the enemy, such as, like they were asking me, what strikes were planned into that area the next day. As I pointed out earlier, after those 3 days, I just thought in my own mind, well, any information that I might have, or that I did have, I still ended up not giving them, but even had they gotten it out of me at that point, it was already, plans had, you know, way past the time when those strikes were planned and or had already gone, and so I really, I didn't have to worry anymore, I didn't think, because I knew nothing past that 3 days. So I figured after that point that the valuable information that they might have gotten out of me that could immediately have brought harm to anybody else was negated. So although I never ended up telling them that, if they had forced any more information, I couldn't have told them anything, because even if they had torched me to death, because I didn't know anything after that point. So I think that immediately after capture is a time when it's most important to resist any answering any military information. After that, my hometown and some of this other information that was not really that important, I think that if you can resist telling them, my feeling is you shouldn't tell them a damn thing if you can get away with it. But if you can, you're forced to it, you can give them information that is of no value, or that they already know and they're just trying to fill a little block or something, interrogator comes in and says, well, you have to check off these squares and before you're finished with that guy. Well, hell, I'll give them that information, but information about the frequencies of radars and equipment in the airplane, stuff like that, formations, airspeed, stuff like that, I think that's still very important to try to protect, even after the initial 3 days. I think we'll see some changes come out. Hopefully that we'll have a more realistic code to live with.
Okay, one last subject, please, Commander. You get back to the States now, you get a chance to get caught up on all of the world news and so forth and so on. And putting that together with your combat experience, your POW experience and so forth, could you sort of cap off the entire series of interviews with your general overall impressions of the Vietnam War and your participation in it?
Okay, well, as I stated earlier in the interview, I'd been there four times. I'd owned 300 missions, combat missions in Vietnam. I think that we can see right now by following the news that the North Vietnamese have no intentions of living up to the agreements that they've signed in Paris. With all the stockpiling of arms and the improvement of airfields and everything down south, Khe Sanh, I think it's just a matter of time before they again try and overtake South Vietnam. I don't agree with the My Lais and the atrocities and this type of thing that Americans had committed in the South. I think that's deplorable on both sides for anything like this to happen. But I think that the United States government, if we failed to meet our treaties just because it's an unpopular thing, well then our credibility in the world is just going to go right down. If we had not honored the treaty that we had with South Vietnam to help protect them, then I think that we're, as a nation, we're liars.
And did we have a treaty or an understanding?
Well, whatever. I think it was a commitment that we made. And just as I think we have an obligation to honor the commitments as a nation, just as we have, as individuals, an obligation to honor commitments that we make. Like I say, since I've been back, the Vietnamese war, of course, it's now that the POWs are back and the troops are out, it's kind of died down. It's not the popular cause anymore for everybody to march in the streets and on campuses and everything. But I think that the Vietnamese war has hurt the country and it's torn it apart a lot. The various factions, pro and con. I don't know, history is, I guess, going to be the best judge of this, but I think it's hurt the country. We got a great country here, but that war has hurt it. But I think that whether it was a, well, I don't know, I just think that, as I said earlier, we were there because we had an agreement, we had a commitment to that country, and I know damn good and well that the North Vietnamese do plan on taking over there, and I just think that any time that we can protect a country or help a country, stay away from that communist way of life, which I saw firsthand, I think that we have an obligation to try to help them. The country since I've been back, of course I wasn't gone that long, it hasn't changed a heck of a lot since before I was shot down. I wasn't really shocked or surprised by a lot of things that were going on back here, like some of the guys that were shot down 6-7 years, I'm sure. But and I still think we got a good country, and I think that energy crisis and everything aside, I think that the American people can get their stuff back together and get on with it. I think we can go on from here after the Vietnam.
You brought up one point, Commander, and then I will let you go. You were here in this country off and on during the mass demonstration, anti-war demonstrations and so forth, and then you were captured relatively late in the war.
Right.
Did the POWs who had been captured earlier know about this anti-war movement, and if so, what was their general reaction to it?
Yes, they did. They were... That's the kind of information that the Vietnamese always let get through. Anything bad or anything that was in their favor, they would always tell the POWs. Good information about the United States was never let through. The effect on the other POWs, of course, it was one of real despair to think that all this stuff was going on. There they were, languishing away in prison. The bombing had stopped during that period of time in 68. And a lot of them I talked to, they just thought that, well, hell, you know, what's going on? We're being left here to just rot away, and the people in the United States are demonstrating and against the war and everything. They couldn't understand it, I don't think. And had a very, very detrimental effect on their morale. And this type of thing, as I said, that and the visits by the other people helped prolong the war. I fully believe that in my own mind, that all those demonstrations and everything helped prolong the war, because the Vietnamese are very, very conscious of world opinion. And it wasn't until the letter-writing campaigns and dumping letters on their doorstep in Paris and the POW bracelets and the Vivas and all the other organizations for release of the POWs, and that they really realized that this country of hundreds of millions of people were not going to forget a handful of 500 people. And I think that's probably inconceivable to the Asian mind, how we could worry about such a small number of men. And because they don't value life that much. And I think that, as I said, it was world opinion that turned the tide in favor of the POWs, and when their treatment started getting better was because of the letter-writing campaigns. So all the demonstrations and everything did nothing but aid the enemy in the fact that they gave them a false sense or false idea that this is the way every American thought demonstrations against the war. They thought that they were going to win the war here in the United States by public opinion. That's what turned the thing around. That and the B-52s and the mining of the harbor and all the rest of it that we should have done back in 1965.
Thank you very much, Commander. Do you have anything else that you would care to add of your own?
No, just sure is nice to be back.
Thank you very much, Commander.
Okay, Kim.